Good morning, I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Two visitors to Hawaii are on today's agenda. UC Berkeley economics professor Enrico Moretti gives us a perspective on Hawaii as a center of growing innovation. Later this hour, we'll also talk with Palestinian-American law professor Noura Arakat, who says the rule of democratic law should prevail for all in Israel, and she believes it's only a matter of time before that happens. It's Tuesday, December 2nd. From HPR2, it's The Conversation.
And abuse of prescription drugs may be the dirty secret of many otherwise upstanding folks, but how can doctors lessen the problem? I'm Chris Vandercook. That's a question a new documentary hopes to ask. Filmmaker Edgy Lee gives us some of the backstory to her new film, and we'll talk with a UH student who's in line for a prestigious video award with one of her very first efforts.
We'll talk right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
And good morning. Just had a little bit of proof that there is no genre we won't touch musically to
I
get a
I feel like
music
I'm
going.
In a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Well, I hope we don't have the same outcome as a
exactly.
few of those. That would not be such a good thing. But we hope that there will be some better outcomes for Hawaii, economically speaking. And you know that for decades now, we've heard that Hawaii is well poised to be a base of technological innovation. But is it? Within the context of innovation clusters, those who advocate for greater resources and attention to Hawaii say it's now at a crossroads. This week, UC Berkeley economics professor Enrico Moretti will talk to elected officials and students about what he sees in our state's future as a creative industries hub. But first, he joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
You talk a lot about brain hubs and innovation clusters. How would you put Hawaii into that context?
But when you look at the economic performance of American cities and states, you see enormous variation in that context. Some cities and some states have a very high penetration of innovation and highly educated workers. Others have a very little penetration. In the first group, there are cities like San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, Austin, Raleigh, Durham, Boston. I would say that Hawaii is in the middle of these two extremes. It has good fundamentals, but it doesn't really have developed a world-class innovation cluster just yet.
So we really are at that point where we either kind of fish or cut bait. We either go for it or kind of be content to be in the middle?
I think you are. I mean, historically, Hawaii has relied on tourism and construction as main engine of economic growth and job creation. But if you look forward, probably those two industries are unlikely to continue providing the same rate of economic growth and job creation and wage creation as in the past. And I think that when you look at the experience of other American cities, the importance of innovation and a highly skilled labor force comes across as the key determining factor for future growth.
When you talk about highly skilled or a highly skilled labor force, are you speaking only of the tech industry? Because we've seen that tech seems now to be so pervasive. It runs through so many industries. Are you really saying that we're looking for highly skilled workers throughout many industries and that tech just happens to be a big component of it?
Yeah, I think innovation is much broader than tech. In a place, where I live, which is the San Francisco Bay Area, innovation equals tech. But there are other experiences. For example, if you look at Boston or Raleigh-Durham, their innovation is more to do with life science than tech. If you look at L.A., innovation has a lot to do with entertainment and design. So each city and each state have to create their own version of innovation. What all these sectors have in common is the fact that they make something that is unique. It's a product or a service that is unique and is new, and it cannot be outsourced very easily in the short run. And therefore, it provides a good source of job creation.
In Hawaii, we think that what is unique about us is our geography, is the beauty that surrounds us, is the people, that all of these things, that's what makes us unique. But in terms of innovation and an innovation hub, where do you see Hawaii having something that is equally as unique?
Well, I think that natural amenities are part of the answer, but not the entire answer. Across the United States, you see a lot of cities and a lot of states that have beautiful amenities. Maybe not as beautiful as Hawaii. Nobody get close to that. But you see a lot of cities and states that have beautiful amenities, but really struggle at creating a self-sustaining private sector innovation hub. So I think that it helps a lot to have good amenities, and it helps a lot to have the type of world-class natural amenities that one has. But that's just part of the answer. The other part of the answer has to do with education of the workforce, and at all levels, especially at a higher level. So we're talking about the workers with master degrees or college degrees or associate degrees. When you look at the experience of American cities over the past 10 years, those who have done the best in this decade are the ones that have the largest share of workers with a college degree or a master degree in the workforce. And I think that's one place where Hawaii can really be successful, because a lot of these people really would like to be located in a beautiful place like Hawaii.
So you're advocating that we have to put more attention into post-secondary school?
Yes, absolutely. Post-secondary school, as well as the connection between high school and college, which is the community college. That's also a very important driver of worker skills. So, and that's a very there's mounting economic research that shows that the economic return on investing on public education at that level, so community college and at the college level, has enormous economic benefit for the community.
Well, that seems to be reasonably intuitive, but specifically as you view Hawaii and what you say is unique about Hawaii and the fact that we're sort of poised between, sort of being a center of innovation, yet not quite, but we've got a lot of the good, bones to be there. What do you think we need to do specifically with our educational system that would support the kind of jobs that you talk about that are going to be so meaningful in the coming decades?
I think that there is mounting evidence from research that states that invest in the skills of their labor force and the workers tend to have faster economic growth in the long run. So this is the type of investment that pays for itself. The type of investment that that in the long run actually doesn't cost taxpayer money, because it the benefits vastly exceed the cost. So that's one part of the equation, is how many workers have those skills. The other part is how to attract employers who are going to be employing these workers. As I said, there's no one single recipe. I don't think you want to look at Silicon Valley and say, well, I'm going to copy Silicon Valley and reproduce it in Honolulu.
No, that's why I'm asking you what you think that Honolulu, what you think Honolulu or Hawaii in general should be doing that might be different from those other cities that you've been talking about.
Well, for example, I'm always hesitant when cities and states come to me and they ask me what sector should we build, because as I said, the answer is not a single one for every state. It really depends on the condition on the ground. But I would say that historically, you have a presence, for example, of research in the connect with the agricultural sector. That's only part of the innovation sector. That's only part of a sector that will probably keep growing in the future. We keep generating good jobs. That's one example. Design of whether it's high-end design or design of sport equipment. That's also part of the innovation sector. It's something that generates a product that is unique and new, and that. You also have the advantage that a lot of people associate Hawaii with a very positive image of Hawaii. So I think a design in Hawaii could be a very good competitor with the design in California that Apple had for many decades. So you have many competitive advantages, and I think what you have to do is to build on those as well as expand the supply of highly skilled workers in the state.
Giving new meaning to what it means to be made in Hawaii. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Enrico Moretti is professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco and a consultant to the World Bank. His research has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and CNN. The New Geography of Jobs is his most recent book. He'll be speaking about growing Hawaii's innovation economy at ProtoHub Honolulu on Thursday. This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's now coming up to 8:15. Later in the show, the mysteries of the box jellyfish explored in an award-winning student video. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're taking a look at the origin of the Queen Liliuokalani Trust. On today's date, over a century ago, Queen Liliuokalani created a deed of trust that established both the legal framework and a financial backing for an institution dedicated to ensuring the welfare of orphaned Hawaiian children. A couple of years later, the Queen amended her original wording to include impoverished children as well. In the deed of trust, she stated, "All the property of the trust estate, both principal and income, shall be used by the trustees for the benefit of orphan and other destitute children in the Hawaiian Islands. The preference given to Hawaiian children of pure are part Aboriginal blood." Queen Liliuokalani died on November 11, 1917, and to this day the institution created in her deed continues on through the work of the Liliuokalani Trust and Children's Center. We told you the deed of trust dates back to this day over a century ago, so for today's quiz, we want you to tell us the exact year. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. If not, stay tuned and we'll have it for you in the next half hour. The latest generation of college students has come of age in a world where a whole new type of literacy is called for, one that uses the once specialized language of film production to tell its story. It seems to come naturally to Amanda Schell. One of her early efforts has been named one of 12 semifinalists in the Second Lab TV Tribeca National Video Awards contest. Her subject is the box jellyfish and the scientist who studies them, and she's with us in our studio this morning. Good morning, Amanda.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You got a hold of a very photogenic subject for your video, didn't you? Tell me about that subject.
So this video, it was a profile piece on UH's Dr. Yana Gihara, Dr. Angel Yana Gihara. Mm-hmm. She is a researcher at UH, and her specialty is jellyfish research. So that's what she specializes in.
And she got interested after she got good and stung, didn't she?
Yes, years ago she was swimming in Waikiki, and a jellyfish, the tentacle actually wrapped around her throat, and she had to make her way back to the shore, and she passed out and came to on in an ambulance. And so from then on, that really inspired her research.
When she found out just how intense these little guys are, huh?
Yeah, they're something else. And the complexity, they have 24 eyes, and I want to say four of those are as complex as the human eye. So they're really fascinating creatures, really.
And they come to the beach on the night of the full moon?
Yes, and that week, that's when the influx comes in. And so we had up to 100 the night I went out in Waikiki.
Which poses the fact that the research and the gathering is done in the pre-dawn hours, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, we were out there at 3 in the morning.
A little bit of a photographic challenge.
It was. I'd say the biggest challenge was the lighting. Everything in the video was lit with flashlights, but it made it fun and interesting, a really interesting experience.
You know, when you're shooting a documentary, there's this thing that happens when you're shooting where no matter what you planned for, something is going to surprise you, right?
Oh, definitely. Something always doesn't go as planned, but that's part of the challenge. You know, you have to overcome it. And I was very happy with the final product.
Did you always feel comfortable with this particular type of language as a means of communication, as opposed to, say, written language or pictures alone?
Well, it's a little bit more difficult because it is more medically and...
I mean, the information itself.
The information itself is quite heavy, and so I did have to meet with Dr. Yanagihara several times to just gain a better understanding of the topic, the subject matter.
And that was before you shot the video for
this? Yes, sir, yes. And I want to say one of the challenges was pushing that information in a way that your everyday person could understand.
What were your various ways you could have done that?
Just as far as becoming really, you really have to study what you're trying to deliver to what everyone's watching, really.
And do you sort of maybe work backwards from what people might take away, you know, what they're most likely to remember? Because it's easy for the information to get pretty complicated.
It is. And I had a lot of guidance from Tina Shelton, my boss at the medical school. She was a in journalism for quite a while, and so she was able to help me really develop that in a way that was enjoyable, but at the same time getting that information across.
Because you had a lengthy interview with your subject, Dr. Yanagihara.
I did. It was about 45 minutes long.
And so were you able to cull from that most of the stuff that you needed to present?
Yes, I was, and I still had to go back and correspond afterwards, but the interview, pretty much, I had my questions ahead of time, which is really important, too. You have to know what you're aiming for in your story piece.
Well, because you can take information and just get everybody kind of lost in the tall weeds if you present too much, huh?
Yes, you really have to choose what you want to get across and simplify that in a way that... It's easy to get across.
Sometimes I find when I've been working on a project for a long time, my level, I almost get to know too much about it so that I lose that connection with what the audience might be able to take in. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, definitely. And that was something I was working through as well, because I met with her twice before actually going out to help her collect, or going out when she was collecting the samples. But I really had to weed out what was important, and that was the profile. I didn't want to lose that. That was the goal of the project, to present the doctor in a way that can show her research. It was a profile piece.
Because, it's a story of research, but it's a personal story as well, right?
Yes, definitely, and I wanted to add that element, that personal element as well. I didn't want it to be strictly this medical or this very technical, video.
But you found out in the course of it that when box jellyfish come in, you would gather, and in how large an area of Waikiki would you gather, say, 100 at a time?
Well, when we went out, we were just right there on the pier, on the shore right there, and we didn't go any farther than that, and so that's right there on the shore. That's where we collected the 100 and some odd jellyfish.
Because this, her project involves taking a census. They go out in a given area and they try to correct every single one in that area.
Yes, they do, and they have to do that because we have surfers out there, we have tourists, and this is just in Waikiki, right there on the beach. You know, everyone's out there, so that's really important.
Did you find that tourists don't really know much about this or anything about this, do they?
I didn't know anything about this until I took this project on, and so it's fascinating.
Was that part of the fun?
It definitely was. I mean, I don't know any other job you could go jellyfishing at 3 a.m. So it's an experience.
Well, that's a good point. Well, I've seen the video. It really looks good. Most of it uses her words to tell the story. Did you find that was a really effective way?
I believe so, because like I said, it was a profile piece, so I really wanted to focus on her. I did a intro narration with a little time lapse, but then I really just wanted to focus on her and her research. Her story.
Well, I get the feeling you're going to be staying with this kind of work, Amanda, so it's good to talk to you.
I hope so. Thank you.
Amanda Shell is a senior in journalism at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, who works in the Student Employment and Cooperative Education Service in the John A. Burns School of Medicine's Communications Department. Her video about Dr. Angel Yanagihara has been named one of 12 semifinalists in the second Lab TV Tribeca National Video Awards contest. And details are at hpr2.org.
Well, you mustn't go to swimming in the salt water, in the salt water, in the salt water. No, you mustn't go to swimming in the salt water when the box jellyfish are there. Well, you can't see them hiding in the salt water, in the salt water, in the salt water. No, you can't see them hiding in the salt water, but the box jellyfish are there.
Good morning. I'm Cody Sugai from Kapilani Children's Miracle Network. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The state's decision to release James Pfluger last Friday to detention in his Hawaii Kai home might have struck you as a privilege of the wealthy. He'd been sentenced to prison following the Koloko Dam disaster that killed 7 people in 2006 and had served only 7 months. Civil Beat editor Padley Etler has today's reality check about why the decision was the right one for the state. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
There were a lot of people who were really upset about this, that somehow to reduce the lives of those 7 people killed to a mere 7 months in prison seemed to be highly inappropriate. But that really is a separate argument that had nothing to do with why the state decided that Mr. Pfluger should no longer be in prison.
That's correct. Apparently what happened is it was well known that Mr. Pfluger had some heart problems and a history of heart trouble, but he was the day that he was sentenced, he was incarcerated that day, kind of caught prison officials by surprise, and they hadn't really planned on how to handle a guy 89 years old with heart problems. So that is what the issue has boiled down to, that he might have been not placed correctly in the Kauai Correctional Facility, and there's no real medical care for him there, so he was given a release.
Medical care for him there or in any of Hawaii's prisons?
Really in any of Hawaii's prisons, but I think Ted Sakai, the prison's director, thinks had they had a little bit more time to plan it out and think about it, they might have been able to come to a different solution. But nonetheless, what happened was that he was put in the Kauai Correctional Facility. There was no appropriate medical care there, and the state feared a lawsuit or some sort of an Eighth Amendment case, cruel and unusual punishment that he was being held without appropriate care.
And that's something that already has precedent in Hawaii.
It does, yes. There's been a couple of lawsuits, one that cost the taxpayers about $1 million for that very reason, when an inmate was not given the right medical care.
And is there any other way of being able to monitor him other than just that he has, an ankle bracelet at home and he has to stay within the confines of his home?
I believe that is the case. I think really what it boils down to is, so what sort of planning and facilities the prison system really has, and certainly upgrading the prisons and, doing some improvements are things that both Governor Abercrombie, former Governor Abercrombie, and now Governor Ige are interested in doing. So this might be turn out to be some sort of a, driving force behind some different ways of doing things.
And changing a precedent of a different type.
Exactly.
Right.
So,
well, at this point, there's really not much else that's going to happen with it except to say that as other inmates who are supposed to be cared for in the same way that we would care for anybody else in the state, that really is the issue, and whether or not we're going to be able to have funds to make that happen too, because that's going to mean additional medical equipment and additional personnel.
Oh, no doubt, Beth Ann. You're absolutely right about that.
All right. We're going to leave it there for the moment. Thanks, Patty. Talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Patty Epler is the editor of CivilBeat.com. Now something that has filled international news for decades, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Noura Erekat says it's a 20th century issue and it will need a 21st century solution. The Palestinian-American law professor from George Mason University has been speaking in Honolulu. We talked by phone about the historical context for a problem that dates back to the days of T.E. Lawrence, when Great Britain and France were carving up the Middle East. I asked her about the alliances and counter-alliances over the past century and if she thought the Palestinians were pawns in a much larger strategy.
I think Palestinians are at a point where they're not pawns. They might not have influence and therefore can't exercise their national self-determination in the ways that they would want, but I do not think that they're pawns, right? Because they are represented by the Palestinian Authority, governed by Fatah, as well as by Hamas, in the Gaza Strip. What we see fall apart since the advent of the peace process in 1993 is the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which represented all Palestinians regardless of their geographic location as a national holistic body. And Palestinians today, to some extent in a very broken representational system, represent themselves but don't have either the national leverage, don't have national economies, don't have any kind of effective armies, don't have any type of leverage so that they can represent themselves in their interests. And in fact, today, Fatah, which represents the Palestinian Authority predominantly, has been unable to shift course and to resist Israel's ongoing settler colonialism and U.S. dictates on these issues because they're reliant on foreign donor aid for survival because they don't have a national economy. And so they can't resist the U.S. They can't, for example, take Israel to the International Criminal Court so easily because they would risk losing one-third of their national budget, which is provided by the United States. And in the West Bank, at least 40% of the population is part of the public sector. And so any now resistance has very, very deep and destabilizing implications, which I think are worthwhile nonetheless, but which make this a bit more complicated, so that they're not pawns. They're not being played by anyone, but they're also been incapacitated so that they can't adequately represent themselves.
Noura, there are concerns that external support, for example, for Hamas, is being done by countries that would like to see the destruction of Israel and that they're working through the Palestinians. So if they're not pawns, are they also perhaps witting or perhaps unwitting supporters of a strategy that would see the destruction of Israel?
I think we have to critically examine what this means, because this is part of creating a lexicon of words and code words that stand in for something much more complicated. For many ardent Zionists, their belief that the destruction of Israel is not actually the removal of Jewish people from the land. They're referring to the destruction as the destruction of a demographic majority of Jewish people. So they are characterizing the right of return of refugees, a human right for Palestinians who are displaced from their home. They're characterizing the acquisition and the benefit and the enjoyment of that human right as the destruction of a state. And I think we need to critically examine if a state is built on a demographic equation that has to be socially engineered and results in systematic human rights violations in order to be maintained, then is it in fact not the problem? So we really need to critically examine what that means when people say you want to destroy the state. Palestinians don't want to destroy the people, nor do they want to displace the people. This is about being able to live with them as equals and to coexist with them. Now, if that's the problem, then maybe we also need to reevaluate our own moral compass of what we'd like to see in the future of states being built, what we mean when we say democracy in the rest of the world. And so that's actually where our conversation should be about, rather than using these code words, which obfuscate the process of settler colonialism, and one which removes, displaces, and dispossesses Palestinians systematically and daily, even in the absence of kinetic violence or military warfare. So today in Jerusalem, and as for decades, Palestinian Jerusalemites are being removed simply because they are not Jewish. They do not have Jewish nationality. Are we okay with that? We shouldn't be. I hope we're not. And if we ascribe to a set of principles that we all believe in, we would abhor the removal of Palestinians, similar to the removal of any indigenous population from their home.
So, Nora, it seems that you're really separating the idea of the rule of law that should be equal to all who reside there, as opposed to a strategy that might see not just dilution of the Jewish population, but the end of it.
So there's no end of the Jewish population. And this code word you're using for dilution, within Israel today, Israel has sole legal, political, and military jurisdiction over Israel, as well as the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It has eviscerated the two-state solution by expanding its settlements into the West Bank, and so that now it's proposing to annex it, and has explicitly said we're okay with apartheid rule because we want to annex what we believe is historically Judea and Samaria. And so Israel has single-handedly destroyed the two-state solution by its own policy. Because of its sole jurisdiction, if you look at the population demographics today, there are 1.2 million Palestinians within Israel. They are citizens of the state, but they are second-class citizens. There are 1.8 million in the Gaza Strip, and there are 2.5 million in the West Bank. In contrast, there's approximately 6 million Jewish Israelis in the region. Already, that demographic balance that Israel seeks is destroyed and is tenuous. The only way to maintain that socially engineered demographic balance is to exclude Palestinians altogether. So to create them and to make sure that they are outside the legal system and exist as civilians and persona non grata. That is the situation we are witnessing. So to say that this is a dilution of the population or a removal of it, in fact, that population today is already somewhat in balance, and the only way Israel is able to maintain what is a fake demographic majority is by excluding Palestinians altogether, relegating them to no man's land where no law and no self-representation exists at all.
Which is why you've been saying that this is a long-standing Palestinian problem, that Israel has not an issue of national security. But having said all the things that we've talked about today, do you honestly think that there's a one-state solution that will be possible and that will be amenable to both Palestinians and Israel? Is it possible?
I think that it's absolutely possible because it's inevitable. And what exists today for analysts that are paying attention is a one-state reality. There is already one state that exists, and it's one where Israel has geographic, military, and political jurisdiction over all the land. Now, what is impeding the move from the situation where we have today, where the population is inextricably populated, where Israel already has exercises one state jurisdiction? What is impeding the movement from where we are today of domination and subjugation of Palestinians to a state where it is one state where all people are equal looks much like the South African model of ending apartheid. That this is already possible, it's already the reality. What we have to work on now is a process of, frankly, decolonizing the psyche that Jewish persons are entitled to superiority, that Palestinians are somehow inferior as a matter of fact, and that, in fact, these are all people who should be living in a single state reality and being able to rule themselves. To get to that place, which is very difficult, it means that we as an international community have to be invested in peace and in a viable solution that doesn't necessitate the removal of Palestinians in order to achieve some sort of viable and sustainable outcome.
That was part of my conversation with Palestinian-American law professor Noura Arakat. She specializes in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and teaches law at George Mason University. More of our conversation will be on our website, hpr2.org.
A come to Jesus moment for one man of the cloth.
Even though you're never alone, it feels like you're alone. I felt alone, but then I looked up and I saw the sun peeping through the clouds.
A father faces his daughter's cancer and it brings them both together. The latest in our online on-air breast cancer series, Under Her Skin. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation. Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, combining technology and engineering to participate in the Cyber Patriot Program and the Real World Design Challenge. SacredHearts.org.
Narcotics, which offer the promise of relief from pain even as they take over your life, are among the deadliest drugs of all, and they can come into your life in insidious ways, often through legitimate prescriptions for real medical problems. Prescription drugs have become one of society's worst problems, and abuse of OxyContin and related medications is on the rise in Hawaii. Filmmaker Edgy Lee examines the problem and its origins in her new documentary, Unprescribed, Prescription for Addiction, which premieres on local television this week. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Edgy.
Good morning.
It used to be that narcotics, heroin, morphine, etc., the drugs that kill pain but also produce that euphoria, were a back alley thing. They weren't something that somebody with a white coat on brought into your life, right?
Opiates, you're talking.
Yeah,
about,
opiates,
right?
Exactly.
And then modern medicine gave us synthesized opioids, OxyContin, Vicodin, oxycodone, morphine, and then later fentanyl. I mean, there's a host of drugs and useful end of life care, critical pain. I mean, there was a reason why it was used, and they were miraculous drugs, and are today.
Well, there still is
the
reason.
Are today. I mean, we're not suggesting that we take these off the market, nor are we saying that they were not useful and they are not miraculous in many ways. But the misuse has escalated in the United States for decades. And we find ourselves, like, for instance, 4% of the world's population we represent. But we also represent in this country 80% of the prescriptions and the use of these kinds of medications, these narcotic pain medications. So what we're seeing today is a rash of overdose, more than cocaine and heroin overdoses and car crashes across the United States. That's what this epidemic, really, this, according to the Centers for Disease Control, calls it. I mean, more people are dying accidentally from pharmaceutical drug misuse.
There are way more pills out on the street than there are people with busted ankles who need the pain medication. Yeah. How'd that happen?
I think, when we started researching the film, I have to credit Mark Cohen, our lead writer. It was about a year. And what would we hear in our studio? I didn't know that. Like, can you believe this? It was a shocking revelation that, and so we covered the history in, only 58 minutes, it'll be, the film on Wednesday night on KGMB at 9. We covered the history because it was important to understand how did we get here. And, of course, we can't answer it in a little flash of time, but we can give the audience, and hope we did successfully, a very nice overview of where we were, ancient times, into the 19th century, into modern medicine, and then all of a sudden, what happened? World War I and World War II. And I think it's really fascinating. I don't want to get into it too deeply. I want people to come and watch. But it is absolutely surprising. I mean, it's not only this country in terms of use of amphetamines and opioids, but we really are sort of in front of the crowd.
That figure you cited earlier about 4% of the population, the disproportionate, mm-hmm. it argues that we have a whole different cultural approach to medication, that we, in effect, solve problems by taking a pill.
Yes, we do.
Is that part of the history that you're tracing?
Absolutely. We're looking at the psychology and actually the culture of how we address pain, physical and emotional pain. And in America, we seem to be popping a lot of pills.
We make pain go away without making the source of the pain
right.
go away. And if you make the pain go away, who cares, right?
That's
the pill culture.
One of the fascinating revelations was when we spoke with Alan Johnson at Hinamalka, local rehab center. He said what they're seeing now is something they've never seen before. Two things. First is elderly people are coming in, over 65. People who never drank alcohol, let alone did any kind of street drug, are coming. The families actually are bringing in like grandpa and grandma because they're now addicted to a pain medication. Or it could be a benzodiazepine, which would be like a Valium or a Xanax, addicted where they never even knew what hit them when it embedded itself in the family. And that was perhaps because of a backache or an injury on the job or, a slip and a fall. And now all of a sudden you got grandpa who's addicted to OxyContin and it's wreaking havoc throughout the family. This is what we're seeing in Hawaii. We interview in this film a number of people. Young 20-year-olds, Adderall, opioids turned to heroin, housewives, wonderful family life, everything was fine, and all of a sudden she found herself addicted to, again, painkillers and benzodiazepines. We talked to IHS Connie Mitchell and her colleagues about homeless people, elders on the street, and when they're coming in with bags of medications. And again, and a host of doctors, by the way, medical professionals, who do not disagree with the question that's being asked nationally. This is not just a Hawaii problem, but nationally, how did we get here? What are we doing? And how are we going to stop this? Because it is really a serious issue.
It's kind of a put the toothpaste back in the tube problem now because the sheer numbers of pills on the street way, way out distances the number that are being prescribed, right?
Yeah, it's at our in our home actually. When you say on the street, Chris, we think about street drugs. Right?
Yeah.
This is in your own home.
It's in the medicine cabinet.
Yes, and when you're leaving medications this powerful, scheduled medications, it's like leaving a loaded gun. I mean, are you going to leave a loaded gun in your medicine cabinet for your 10-year-old? I mean, one of the most poignant interviews we do in this film was with a gentleman who was in law enforcement, drug enforcement, as a matter of fact, undercover drug enforcement. And it was just tearful. He said, you know, I didn't recognize the signs. He'd see his son sitting in the corner, you know, became a little bit more quiet, drinking a soda, blue. He thought, oh, a new soda. It was NyQuil mixed with synthetic opioids, OxyContin. His son is now in a coma. It's been 3.5 years. Mm. And this is someone whose business it was. His whole career was based on drug interdiction. And he didn't recognize it. So that is to say, the average family probably does not, statistically, tell their kid, you know, beware of this street drug, beware of alcohol, marijuana, and also beware of these medications. But the comment we got from a whole varied array of people was, we thought it was safe because it was prescribed.
Yeah.
And so we all have to be more alert, definitely.
Given that alertness, we also, and there have been some legal changes recently that on the protocols that doctors follow to prescribe pain medication, but there are always going to be illegal sources.
There are going to be illegal sources, and it's more difficult to obtain these kinds of medications. So now what we are seeing across the country, specifically states like Vermont, Massachusetts, and again, Alan Johnson at Hinamalca said they're seeing a rise in heroin addiction because people are turning to street heroin, which is cheaper and easier to get than some of these pharmaceutical painkillers. I mean, who would think that would ever happen?
That's incredible, yeah.
And that's actually, you know, an aspect of this that we said, you know, we should make a film. And we're really thankful. Our funding, you know, funding is very tight these days, especially on a subject that's not really a happy subject like this. It's an alert for the public.
You know, Edgy, I was in rural Vermont at the end of summer, the beautiful bucolic picture postcard area, seeing junkies nodding out on the street in little Vermont towns.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that's what we've got, isn't it?
And I think we're hoping that people tune in and families tune in, and they look, and they get, and people in the medical profession.
Well, a change of consciousness started this problem, and one can end it, theoretically. Edgy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Edgy Lee's new documentary, Unprescribed, Prescription for Addiction, premieres tomorrow night on KGMB television, and you can get details at hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the Exceptional Checking Account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
We didn't forget about this morning's backyard quiz answer. Here it is. This morning, we checked the history books for a look at the origin of the Queen Liliuokalani Trust. On today's date, over a century ago, her deed of trust, which did, among other things, establish the legal structure and funding for an institution dedicated to benefit orphan Hawaiian children. 2 years later, she amended the original wording of the deed to also include impoverished children. Queen Liliuokalani died in November 1917, and to this day, the institution she created continues her work. We mentioned that the deed of trust dates back to today's date, over a century ago, and we asked you to name the exact year. It was 1909. Tomorrow, we'll take another trip through our backyard, and in the meantime, if you have an idea for a backyard quiz, you can send it in to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
In HBR's Atherton studio on Saturday, December 6th, it's Standards and Other Delights with Rachel Gonzalez, one of Hawaii's top jazz vocalists and music pals and pros, Les Peets, Dean Taba, and Scott Schaefer. Their original arrangements of jazz standards, pop, folk, and more are sure to delight. Reserve your seats by calling 955-8821 during business hours or at hprtickets.org. That's Saturday, December 6th at 7:30.
I was listening to your conversation with Edgy about her new film, and so much of what we don't understand about how people can so easily become addicted to prescription drugs and somehow fool themselves into thinking that it's really okay because it came through a doctor.
Yeah, we used to be able to put addiction and the problems of addiction in society at a remove because those were junkies. They bought it in the alley. They weren't, you know, your neighbors in the suburbs, but they are now.
Or your mother or your father, exactly. Or your grandma, grandpa, or somebody else in your family.
And any kind of a condition where you have chronic pain is going to involve you, if the pain is that severe, in drugs of this stripe with OxyContin or something really powerful, because there are really only a few medications that address pain to a really intense degree like that. So there's very legitimate medical need for these. They are, in the right context, miracle drugs. But they're not intended to get you high. And the fact that they do has created this whole separate market. And it's way more than the ones that are being prescribed. They're being brought in all kinds of ways.
And the fact that when you have someone who may legitimately need those pain pills, but then their tolerance develops to the point where they need more and more and more, and in some cases will go from one doctor to another to be able to fill that prescription. Of course, and neither doctor or other doctors won't know that. That's how easily it is for someone to be addicted, and more of that is going to come out in that. And we should say that our own Bill Sage is doing all of the narration for that too. Anyway, that's going to do it for us for this day. We'll be back with you tomorrow. And we're going to be following up on last week's Big Island GMO moratorium, a decision that overturned it. We'll find out from the director of the Center for Food Safety what they expect to do now.
And there's a casting call on Kauai for a modern American theater classic.
There are lots of ways for you to be in touch with us. The best way is probably just to look on our website, hpr2.org.
And if past shows and links to more information about guests and topics, lots of other good things are on our website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.